Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Surely you know the name Pixar. People all around the world know the name Pixar by now. And the stream of superb films that they have managed to produce over the years, achieving an extraordinarily high level of success. What most people do not know is that all of this began in very, very modest fashion. And in many respects, for some time, the story of Pixar was a very unpromising one. Before the release of their first feature-length film, the groundbreaking Toy Story. But until really the release of that film, it was really a serious point of doubt about whether or not Pixar was going to be a viable company at all, or just what the best way was for them to become financially viable and successful and in a position to do all of the amazingly creative things that that they had in mind. This is a largely untold story until now, that is. I have in hand a really fascinating book called To Pixar and Beyond, My Unlikely Journey with Steve Jobs to Make Entertainment History. The book is written by a gentleman named Lawrence Levy, an attorney by trade and recruited personally by Steve Jobs back in 1994 to become the CFO, the chief financial officer for Pixar Animation Studios, at a time when most of the world did not know the name Pixar, and at a time when nobody had any way of knowing for certain that such glory was ahead for Pixar. This is a book that focuses, for the most part, in a sense, behind the scenes, in that facet of the entertainment world that is not at all glamorous, but it is essential to things happening. And so I'm so grateful to Lawrence Levy for writing this really wonderful book published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm even more grateful that he has made time in his busy schedule to join me to talk about his life at Pixar and some of the intriguing discoveries that he has made since leaving Pixar and engaging in some very important personal exploration that we'll talk about as well. Lawrence Levy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. I'm delighted to be on the show.
I'm so happy for this opportunity. And again, congratulations on a terrific book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So tell us, first of all, about where you were and what you were doing in 1994, the day that the phone rang and Steve Jobs was on the other end. I mean, ahead of the phone ringing, where were you and what were you doing? And how happy were you doing what you were doing?
Well, I was sitting in my office at a company called Electronics for Imaging. That company is still around, actually, but it was had been a startup when I joined it. And we had taken that company public. I was its chief financial officer. And I was very happy there, although I had been there for several years, and the CEO had left, and I was sort of wondering what my next phase might be. And then the phone rang, and I picked up the phone, and it was Steve Jobs. And he said, "Hi, Lawrence, I saw your picture in a magazine a couple of years ago. I thought we might work together one day, and I have a little company I'd like to tell you about."
Tell us about the state of affairs for Steve Jobs and sort of where he was at in his career at this point in time. He is, in 1994, very well known, but in a sense, not at the pinnacle of his success, let's say.
I think he was at the other end of it, largely being written off by many people. And in fact, my first chapter in the book is called "Why Would You Want to Do That?" Because that's what everybody said to me. Steve had been had left Apple some 8 or 9 years earlier, and he really had had a string of products that hadn't made it. His last two product efforts at Apple, the Lisa, the original Macintosh, and then he did the Next computer, and then he did the Pixar imaging computer. None of those products had been successful for various reasons, and so much was being written about him saying that, you know, he was over, he was kind of a Silicon Valley has-been.
And yet, you say in the book that that his reputation was still such, at least in your mind, that a call from Steve Jobs was enough to stop you in your tracks. I mean, this was nevertheless a really big deal for him to reach out personally to you.
It was a big deal. I mean, he was still one of the, he had all the charisma and all the reputation of really being one of the founders of the personal computer industry, and none of that had changed. And so, you know, it was exhilarating to get a call from him, although I was surprised by what that call was about. I thought what he was interested in was turning his then computer company called Next Computer around. And when he said it was about Pixar, like you mentioned earlier, I didn't really know anything about Pixar. I barely even heard of it.
I thought it was interesting as you described this conversation between the two of you, a conversation in person in which you say you, on a personal level, really hit it off almost immediately, had a long, wide-ranging conversation, and in many respects it was a great conversation. But you talk about this really gnawing unease that you felt, particularly as the conversation sort of wound up and you kind of, in a sense, realized what had not been said. Explain to our listeners what made you so uneasy about that first conversation with Steve Jobs.
What made me uneasy about it was the sort of absence of any discussion of any kind of business strategy or plan. By that point of time, especially if you were reaching out to call me to come in as chief financial officer, I would have expected some great sort of thoughts or great insight about what the business plan was, and that was missing in that first conversation. So that was a little warning sign for me, but, you know, otherwise it was a great conversation, and so I proceeded with the next round.
And the next round, in a sense, included a visit to Pixar headquarters in a place called Point Richmond, California, a place you've never been. Describe to our listeners, you do such a great job of it in your book, of what this place looked like, especially sort of the outside of it and the reception area and so on. I mean, talk about unpromising.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for starters, in order to find it, I had to literally, take out a map. There was no Google Maps or anything like that back then. So it was a physical map to locate where it was. And Pixar's original offices turned out to be across the street from a Chevron oil refinery in Point Richmond. And so there was just nothing remarkable about the place. It was sort of, the building was old and dreary and dark and not even that well kept. So when I walked in there, I was like, what is this? You know, there was just nothing about it that was inspiring.
Explain where Pixar had sort of come from. I mean, and the way in which it was essentially sort of a spinoff from Lucasfilm, which, of course, you had heard of.
Yeah, it started out as the computer graphics division of Lucasfilm, and then he spun it off to, in about 1986, Steve Jobs bought it with the vision of making a computer graphics company. They wanted to make an imaging computer. And so that was its genesis, was to do really high-end computer graphics, and it had stumbled along really for the better part of almost 10 years trying to find its way in that business, but never really doing so.
One of the things you discovered upon that visit to Pixar and talking to somebody very high up in the company was you came to a better understanding of exactly the connection between Steve Jobs and Pixar at that point in time, in particular when it came to Steve Jobs' wallet.
Yes, I mean, this was one of the things that surprised me, and I didn't really understand this fully until I had already joined the company, but there had been a very sort of fractured relationship between Steve and the company, although he had funded the company, he had not given sort of stock options to the employees, and the employees there felt that they hadn't been sort of treated fairly over the course of the years. And so there was quite a lot of sort of antagonism between the company and its owner. And I realized that that was really a problem if we were going to really build a viable company.
Right. And, of course, the fact that Steve Jobs was literally pouring millions of dollars into the coffers of Pixar with no clear sense of where any of this was ultimately headed, that also had to be so disconcerting for you in terms of wondering if I have a place in this company.
Absolutely. When I joined the company, the payroll shortfall each month was being covered by Steve's personal checkbook. And so that was very painful for him and for the company as well. So it was definitely a ship that needed to be righted.
So what turns it around, that I don't mean even Pixar, but your own feelings about Pixar and your own feelings about this opportunity that was perhaps about to be extended to you to become a part of Pixar, what sort of swept away at least most of your most serious misgivings was when you were led into an interesting room, one of the most interesting sounding projection rooms I think ever described, not looking anything like a conventional movie theater. Describe the room, and then more importantly, describe what you saw on the screen and its impact on you.
Yes, this was the first time that I visited Pixar. I was still interviewing for the position there, and I walked into their screening room expecting exactly the kind of room that you described. Instead, this is an old room, and it's full of beat-up old couches, the kinds of couches that you would expect to find sort of left at the end of a driveway to be picked up. And on the other one side, there's a screen. On the other side, there's a projector. And you just sat down on any one of these couches and sunk into it. And then with lots and lots of caveats about how unfinished it was, I saw, you know, sort of the first 3 or 4 minutes of Toy Story. And that was just jaw-dropping.
Mm. You also saw a couple of their very fine short films, I think, in that same screening. But Toy Story had the most powerful impact on you, and you found it to be extraordinary. Do you remember what about it had sort of the strongest impact on you? I mean, what was it that you had, in a sense, never seen before or even imagined could be possible?
Well, I had never seen sort of three-dimensional computer animation before, and so the graphics, even though they were at that point in time still a little crude because the film hadn't been finished, but they were mesmerizing. They were just stunning in their sort of complexity and their beauty. But more than that, what happened is that there was a little scene at the beginning of Toy Story where the Green Army men have to go and discover what the new birthday presents are for Andy, and they go on this little adventure, and one of them gets injured. And in the moment when that soldier gets injured, I felt this emotion. I was like, oh, no, is he okay? And I realized that I cared about that soldier, a little green digital army man on a screen in front of me. And it was then I realized that this was much more than computer graphics. This was really about a new medium for storytelling.
Mm. We're speaking with Lawrence Levy, former chief financial officer for Pixar and the author of a really remarkable memoir called To Pixar and Beyond, My Unlikely Journey with Steve Jobs to Make Entertainment History. So we can read in your book about your persistent misgivings, but your ultimate decision to, in a sense, climb aboard this rocket called Pixar, although at that point, no one had any idea that the kind of rocket that it was and the heights to which it was destined. I mean, at that point, you didn't know if it was a rocket or a sinking ship.
Explain
to our listeners exactly what your mission was, your purpose, I mean, what did Steve Jobs have in mind? What did he want you to do with Pixar?
Well, two things. The first thing was to create a viable strategy to grow the company. So something that would turn it into a growth, profitable, viable company that didn't depend on its owner for monthly financing. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was that if that worked, was to orchestrate the public offering of Pixar, where Steve would be able to sell some of his stock in an offering that then the public could participate in owning the company.
One of the first things that you did upon arriving at Pixar was that you asked each member of Pixar's senior team if you could shadow them. I would love for you to describe what that was like. And going into that, what you had in mind. It sounds like you really sort of, you tried to create sort of craft that experience so it would be, in a sense, of the most benefit to you in terms of understanding Pixar.
Yes. I mean, in general, I believe that when you join a new organization of any kind, there's this tendency that you want to sort of try to, make yourself heard quickly or make an imprint or show how much you can contribute to the organization quickly. And I always sort of had the opposite view. My view is that when you join an organization, you actually have kind of a honeymoon period, and there's no real reason to jump and act quickly, and that organizations have a kind of culture or pulse about them that often belies their initial impressions. And so my sense was that I really needed to understand the company, and the only way to do that was to literally just hang out and just be with the people that were there. And so I asked the leaders of the company if I could shadow them for a few weeks, just go around, just sit in meetings, not say anything, take notes. And, that really is helpful at the beginning to sort of get a sense of the beat and the pulse of a place.
How were you received initially at Pixar? I mean, were you received with any sort of suspicion or misgivings by those who were already there? And were you replacing somebody who had already been there in a similar position, or in a sense, had this position been created especially for you?
I was not replacing someone, so in a sense, I was the first person to come in as a CFO, member of the Office of the President, kind of a senior business role like that. But much to my surprise, I was received with a healthy dose of skepticism and misgiving, and I think the reason for that is because I was sort of perceived as potentially Steve's guy, and the company didn't really know what that meant. And so they were afraid that Steve would change the company and the company culture in ways that would be detrimental. And I think they were afraid that I was the agent for that change. And so that's another reason that I decided to slow things down at the beginning and not make any sort of rash or quick decisions that would change things.
That was actually one of the most intriguing things that you described in your book, is this relationship between Steve Jobs and Pixar at this point in time. And of course, on the one hand, you have these very understandable concerns on the part of the folks at Pixar, especially the creative team, so anxious to not be burdened with the interference of Steve Jobs or anybody else from the outside. And on the other hand, here you have Steve Jobs pouring millions of dollars of his own money, and as you point out, writing checks from his own personal account. I mean, who has, in a sense, all the right in the world to at least have a hand in what's going on there? I mean, in so many respects, it was the most uneasy of marriages, and maybe the most unlikely of partnerships. And we're all probably really fortunate that it didn't all go kaboom long before Toy Story was ever released.
Oh, definitely. I think there were times when it was very close to going kaboom, especially in the a couple of years leading to right before that I got there. And so part of the story and part of the reason I wrote the book is because the arc, the change of Steve Jobs' relationship with Pixar was not just a great story, but I think a very important part of understanding him and his life and career as well. And so, you know, his relationship with Pixar really transformed over the 2 or 3 years after I joined the company, and that was very important for Pixar and very important, I believe, for Steve as well.
So at this point in time, Pixar was making its money, albeit not enough money to cover its own bills, far from it, but making its money in several different ways, including creating animated commercials and animated short films and, of course, working on this feature-length film. And then they were also involved in some kind of software called RenderMan. And it sounds like one of the most one of the trickiest things you had to do was, in a sense, ultimately make a decision or help Steve Jobs come to a decision about this software called RenderMan. I mean, in a sense, it was a situation fraught with all kinds of complexity and personal feelings woven into it. Just say a quick word about this. I think it really says a lot about how tricky your challenge was.
Well, RenderMan was at the time a groundbreaking industry standard software for making these really high-end computer images that animated feature films depend upon. And so it was at the heart and soul of everything that Pixar stood for, and Pixar was selling that product. And the challenge with selling it was that there were very few customers for it, very few people doing high-end computer graphics at that level. And so my job was to assess what the viability of RenderMan was as a business. And I came to conclude that if building a big, you know, a company that you could take public was the goal, that it just didn't have any chance of being part of that. And so my job became sort of the unwinding of the effort to sell RenderMan, a product that was sort of near and dear to Pixar's heart, and to sort of dismantle that structure yet keep the technology for Pixar's use. And so, yeah, those were very kind of delicate discussions because, you know, people were sort of attached to that idea that this was being sold on the market as the preeminent product in its field. Hmm.
You ultimately suggest that one thing that Pixar should do is, in a sense, go after money from other companies, including Microsoft, that were almost certainly infringing on its patents. And you describe in really interesting detail your conversations with Steve Jobs over how this matter should be pursued. And he had one idea, and you had another idea, and at the surface, ne'er the twain should meet. But somehow you were able to hammer out an agreement that, which adhered much more closely to your vision of how this delicate matter should be handled. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yes, I put that story in the book because I felt it really illustrated well the way that Steve and I worked together. And so Pixar had these groundbreaking patents on this imaging technology. They were being infringed by other companies. And my approach was to say, you know, Pixar is not in the patent licensing business, but we sure need some money quickly to get us through the short-term period of time. And so let's go to these companies and not try to sort of squeeze out every last dollar, but do a deal that's fair and that will get us something to help us through the short and medium term. And Steve is more prone to want to sort of squeeze out every last dollar. So he doesn't want to leave any money on the table. And so, you know, if I say, you know, I think we should go for $10 million, he might be, we should go for $50. And even though he may be correct that ultimately we might get that, my take was that we need it now and not through the years it would take to do that. And so, but we would you know, discuss these things. And the point was that he didn't kind of, you know, dictate what should be done. It was a process of getting to the right answer, not just doing something because he wanted it that way. And we would talk about these things for hours until we sort of came to a mutually sort of agreeable resolution, and then we would go try to make it happen.
Hmm. We're speaking with Lawrence Levy and talking about his remarkable book called To Pixar and Beyond, My Unlikely Journey with Steve Jobs to Make Entertainment History. Lawrence Levy was the first chief financial officer for Pixar. He came aboard in the mid-1990s, ahead of Pixar having ever released its first feature film, the groundbreaking film Toy Story. At this point, we should talk about what you explore in the fourth chapter of your book, which is called Starving Artist, in which you detail for us what you regarded as kind of a stupefying agreement that had been crafted between Pixar and Disney. It's kind of complicated, and I suppose we don't have time to go through every last detail of it, but I hope you will at least summarize what this agreement meant, and in particular, in a sense, how damaging it was to Pixar, and how urgently you felt it needed to somehow be rectified or dealt with. What was that relationship between Pixar and Disney when you came aboard as CFO of Pixar?
Well, yes. Well, that agreement is testimony to how being naive comes part and parcel with risk-taking. Because if I had known what I later found out about that agreement, I might never have joined Pixar. But Pixar and Disney entered an agreement in 1991 for the making of three animated feature films, the first of which was to be Toy Story. And what was the practice of Hollywood at that time, when you have a big studio like Disney and a fledgling company like Pixar, they tie up the studio lock, stock, and barrel. So the agreement basically prohibits Pixar from doing anything but making films for Disney. If those films are successful, Pixar gets a very small amount of the profits, and the agreement lasts for a very long time. It could be 10, 12 years or even more. So when you added up all the restrictions in the agreement, it looked as though even if Pixar was widely successful with its films, it wouldn't make any money at it, and there was no way to go make them for another studio. And so it felt like a stranglehold on the company's potential.
Although you are obviously coming at this from the perspective of Pixar and understood their position and, in a sense, their pain very, very well, it was your pain, too, once you were aboard. We probably need to acknowledge the fact that Disney was being quite visionary in bankrolling three feature films from a computer animated company that no one had ever heard of to, in a sense, create the kind of movie that no one had ever seen before. That had to be, in a sense, kind of an extraordinary step for Disney to take, right?
Yes, I think so. I think Disney was, who at the time was obviously the king of the hill in animation, right? They'd had Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and those kind of amazing films. And what they wanted to do was to make sure that if anything else was happening in animation that might be important, that they had a hand in it. And so there's this computer animation at Pixar, and there's sort of stop-motion animation, the kind that Tim Burton does, and they made investments in the different things going on in animation just to sort of keep their, make sure they were involved in it. So you're right, it was visionary of them to do that. But also in doing it, they certainly made sure they tied up those companies.
Right. And so in the case of Pixar, for instance, in your words, the impact of all these contractual provisions was crushing. And you also go on to say that in the whole experience, and indeed it sounds like in your whole career in Silicon Valley, you had never felt the kind of hopelessness that you felt when the reality of all this began to really sink in.
It did sink in. I did have some moments a couple of months after I joined Pixar when I felt I had really made a mistake, that all the warning signs that I had seen earlier sort of turned out to be true. You know, you kind of hope that you go in and it's not as bad as you think. And this is one where I went in and it was really, I think, worse than I thought it was going to be. And so, you know, that happens in the Silicon Valley, in the world of startups, but it doesn't feel very good when it happens.
In the next chapter of your book called My Big Break, you take a moment to describe this enormous project that is on the table, so to speak, at Pixar, namely this first feature film, for a long time not even titled, and it set for release on November 22nd, 1995, but as you tell us, that was by no means guaranteed to in fact occur. I mean, they had before them a gigantic challenge of staggering proportions. And I really appreciate the fact that you spell out some of what made the creation of this kind of feature film, which had never happened before, such an overwhelming challenge. Just describe some of what we are talking about here in terms of what made creating Toy Story so fiendishly difficult.
It came down to the fact that a lot of the things that we were trying to accomplish with the film had never been done before. And so that would include things like, you know, the rendering of 110,000 frames of the film with a room full of computers that might take hours or even days to draw just one of those frames. And so it became almost a flirtation with the impossible. Is it literally possible to just draw the images? So that was one example. You know, another example was that even if you had the images on a computer, you had to transfer them to film because that's how films get seen in movie theaters. Pixar had to invent the technology that would transfer those images to film, and there was just one machine that did it. If that machine broke, then the film, it might exist, but it wouldn't be on film, so it couldn't be shown in the theaters. There were a lot of things like that that sort of made this a sort of gargantuan task. I kind of compare it to like ascending Everest for the first time.
And on top of all that, you also experienced something which gives this chapter its title, My Big Break. Describe to our listeners what happened to you.
Well, you know, this was just, I had been kind of despondent about what was going on, and I was just looking for any toehold at Pixar, you know, something where I could grab it and kind of say, okay, at least I know the direction that we need to go in. And around about that time, I don't know, by some great coincidence, I guess, but rollerblading was all the rage back then, and so I was a skater, and I was out of my rollerblades, and I fell, and I broke my leg, but it was a really bad break, and ended up in the hospital having a 12-inch piece of titanium put into my leg to fix it, and then I had to take some time to recover. But in the process of recovering, you know, I had this sort of overwhelming support from people at Pixar and Steve and his family, and even though I'd only been at the company for, you know, maybe 3 months, and somehow, you know, coming out of that, I just got my resolve, and I was just like, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we are going to make this company work somehow. It didn't help any, by the way, that at the time my wife Hillary, who I also recount this story, was 3 weeks away from having our third child, so it was quite a time.
Right, as you describe, I later learned that someone drove to my house and knocked on the door. Hillary answered to hear the words that no woman who is 8 months pregnant wants to hear: "Your husband's been in an accident." Fortunately, it wasn't as serious as those few words might have suggested, and you ultimately recovered, and ultimately helped Pixar find its way towards great success. Along the way, One of the most intriguing conversations that occurred, and it was actually multiple conversations, was around the possibility of whether or not Pixar perhaps should explore creating live-action films as well, and not just these computer-animated films that were so costly and so and took up such vast amounts of time. Describe what these conversations were like, this and this debate over whether or not it made sense for Pixar to venture out into live-action filmmaking. It really helps us better understand, as it sort of helped the folks at Pixar understand, the unique sort of filmmaking in which they were engaged at the moment.
Yes, well, it seems funny looking back at it now, but at the time, you know, 1994, 1995, I was really, in a way, resisting the notion that Pixar would be an independent animated feature film company. And the reason is because the more that I learned about it, the more that I could see that basically no company had ever succeeded in building a company based on that strategy. And you'd think that Disney would have, but, you know, when I looked at Disney's history, they started out with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937. That was the first animated feature film. And then following that, there were a string of, you know, successes, Dumbo, Bambi, and others. But Walt Disney could barely keep the studio afloat, and so he diversified. He went into live-action film. He went into film distribution. He went into theme parks. He went into all these businesses to try to diversify from the risks of pure animation. And so I thought to myself, well, we have to do that too, because how can we, you know, build something that even, you know, no other studio has been able to do? And so one of the first places to look was live-action film, because, you know, I was like, well, maybe we go into live-action films, and then that will help to diversify the risk of these animated feature films. And that began a long dialogue and investigation as to whether that that would be a viable approach for Pixar.
And, of course, what ultimately was decided was that is that this whole realm of computer animated filmmaking, in a sense, allows a level of control that's truly extraordinary, and incredible flexibility along the way to, in a sense, continuously shape and mold the film that you're making in a way that it simply is not possible with live action, and chances are such an exploration in a live-action filmmaking would have not felt right or gone very well for Pixar.
Oh, I think that's true. With live-action film, you shoot your film over a period of 3 months or, you know, 6 months or whatever it is. So you have a bunch of film, and you have to make your movie, you know, basically based on what you shot. With animated feature films, you're constantly changing updating the story through the whole four-year process of making it. The other thing about it was that the business model is different. With animated feature film, you sort of take one shot every 4 years with your film. But with live action film, you kind of, what I learned was you sort of have to make a lot of them. You make 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever and hope that some of them will be hits. So it's kind of like a portfolio business of whereas animated feature films isn't about building portfolios. It's about getting it right every single time. So the culture around making those kinds of films is also different.
I want you to say a quick word about one of the thorniest challenges that you faced as CFO when you sought to write what you regarded as probably the Pixar's greatest failure in terms of how its employees were treated, namely with the matter of stock options. Maybe a brief definition is in order, and then explain what you did to rectify what you thought was a really bad situation.
Well, stock options are really the currency on which Silicon Valley functions in a way, because startups don't have very much cash or capital, and they tend to sort of underpay their employees, but in terms of salary, the way they make up for that is to give employees stock options, which is an option to buy stock in the company that you don't have to do until the company is successful. So if the company doesn't make it, then you, as an employee, have lost nothing. And if the company does make it, then as an employee, you get to benefit from the success of the company through that option to purchase stock. And in a way, that's the way that Silicon Valley mints its sort of, you know, new millionaires or billionaires or whatever. And typically, those stock options are given to employees from the moment they join a company, and even from the very, very beginning of a company. But Pixar, that had been around for, you know, close to 10 years, did not have a stock option plan. And Steve had been promising to put one in. I think at one point there may have been one, and then it was taken away. But there were no stock options when I joined Pixar. This was very rare for a company. I never even heard of it, actually. And so there was probably more angst over that issue than any other, because the employees that had been there for a long time and stuck through the hard times felt that they were not being fairly compensated for their efforts. And that became a big source of sort of dissonance within the company.
Right. And fortunately, you were able to hammer out an agreement that Steve Jobs could live with, as could the employees at Pixar.
Yes, but only just, but yes.
Right. But of course, the really big story is of transforming Pixar by taking it public, which would, in a sense, allow Pixar to have the sort of clout to have greater control over what it created and how what it created would be disseminated to the world. This is a complicated story, but in brief, what were some of the thorniest questions that had to be answered in terms of making this happen?
Yes, the IPO became a sort of central part of Pixar's strategy. And in fact, when I went to write the book, I told my agent, I said, you know, I'm going to make a page turner out of an IPO. That's my goal.
And you did.
I said, I know it's a boring subject, and I know it's not what, you know, everybody knows about, but this was a very exciting story, as exciting as any other, and I think we can show that. And the reason for it was because when a company goes public, investors look for certain criteria in order to make an investment in a company. So they want things like stability, they want growth, they want steadiness, they want predictability. Those are all the things that make for a sort of successful IPO. At least that's the way it was back then. Today, with the new sort of internet companies, we're more used to some instability. But Pixar had none of those features whatsoever. It had no stability, no steady growth pattern. It was dependent on hits. You couldn't easily predict what its revenues or profits might be. So nothing about it looked like a company that investors might be interested in. And so that made for a very challenging sort of effort to try to raise the capital that Pixar needed in order to grow itself as a studio.
Well, and it's just fascinating to think about matters like what should the price be, what should the timing be, and all of this playing out against the backdrop of this first feature film that they were racing to try to finish in time. And you're right, it reads like a thriller. We keep flipping the pages to see how all of this plays out. It had to be frightening, exhilarating, terrifying to be at the heart of it in the moment.
Oh, it is. It's exhilarating. I mean, when you're in a startup like that, you sort of know, you know, you've chosen to be like on a small boat in a big ocean. So you kind of know it's going to get, you know, rough sometimes. You're going to have to paddle really hard. And that's what it was like with the IPO. And, you know, I dealt with that by just being always very candid, very open, you know, not trying to pretend that Pixar was something that it wasn't. And then seeing if the investment community would want to come along with that. And Some of them didn't, but others did. They saw the vision, they saw the possibility, and so we were able eventually to make it happen.
Right. And in the meantime, Toy Story opens, and you describe almost breathlessly that first screening in which you watched the complete film. And you tell us it didn't take long to realize we were watching not just a movie, but the making of film history. And, of course, that changes everything in terms of Pixar's fortunes. So describe why you decided that you and Pixar were to part company. Describe the circumstances in which Pixar ended up sort of entering into a new partnership that, in a sense, changed your position there quite dramatically.
Yes, well, this sort of goes forward to 2006. Pixar had had an amazing run at this point, and there was a decision about whether to renegotiate its contract with Disney and go alone, or what was to be done with that relationship. My own feeling was that Pixar's stock had skyrocketed up so high, its valuation was so high, that it needed to either sort of acquire companies so it could diversify its risk, or be acquired by a company, which is another way of sort of diversifying risk. And at that exact moment, Disney went through a management change. Michael Eisner left, Bob Iger came in, and there was a big question about how important animation was to Disney. One of the reasons that Michael Eisner had left was because the board felt that he had taken his eye off of the animation, and that that was actually part of the heart and soul of the company. And Bob Iger, you know, took that view. He wanted to see Disney succeed in animation, and so that led to discussions that eventually led to the acquisition of Pixar by Disney, which has been an incredible acquisition since it happened in 2006.
Hmm. And for you, you have gone on to, in your words, go on to find your deli, D-E-L-I.
Yes.
Explain what, briefly, I'm afraid, what you have been exploring in your life since leaving Pixar.
Well, I was very aware that there's a certain, I'll call it a one-dimensionality in a way to corporate life. And it's very driven by achievement and performance. And there's nothing wrong with that. It produces incredible things, products, technologies, prosperity. But it's easy to become defined by that kind of performance paradigm and miss out, I think, on other elements of life that are important. And I had a strong interest in discovering what that was all about, how to bring more balance and harmony back to life. And so I, in a nutshell, went off to study Buddhist philosophy and meditation. And that led to a whole sort of different path in life for me. I did discover the things that I was looking for. I did discover that we do sometimes have danger of missing a side of life that can bring us a lot of meaning and joy. And if we want that, there are certain things we have to do to find it. And I went on the journey to discover that.
You describe it so beautifully, and I love the quote of Ann Dillard that you include from her book, The Writing Life. The life of sensation is the life of greed. It requires more and more. The life of the spirit requires less and less. Time is ample, and its passage sweet. You describe more of that in your book, and I urge all who are listening to seek out this book and enjoy it as I have. To Pixar and Beyond, My Unlikely Journey with Steve Jobs to Make Entertainment History, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Lawrence Levy, congratulations on writing a terrific book, and thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming into our studios Dr. James Kinchin, who is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. On Wednesday, a fascinating look at the history of the Jewish people in a book called Diaspora. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor from Carthage College, pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. including these first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. On Friday, two of my favorite interviews from the archives. One of them, a book called Denison, Iowa, a discerning look at a small town in Iowa and what at least many people living in small town America think about the nation and where it is headed.